This presentation has been prepared by Cyforth Shaw, LLP for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. At this time, I'd like to turn today's program over to Robert Milligan with Cyforth Shaw. Mr. Milligan, you may begin.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Thank you all for participating in today's webinar. It's my great pleasure to present to you today's topic, which is the big data revolution, how big data impacts trade secret, computer fraud, and privacy law. Before getting started, I wanted to give you a brief introduction of today's webinar. First, our panelists. We're joined by John Tomaszewski, a senior counsel in Cyforth Shaw's San Francisco office. John is in the field of International Data Protection Practice Group. He has significant experience counseling companies regarding data protection and information security throughout the Americas, Europe, and Asia. He has been a co-author of several information security and privacy publications, including the PKI Accreditation Guidelines on Privacy and Security Information. We are also joined by Anthony Wong from Australia. Anthony is with AGW Consulting. Anthony is the principal of a legal and consulting law practice in ICT, including IP law, cyber law, cloud, and privacy. He has held senior management positions in multinational corporations and government, including as CIO of the Australian Tourist Commission during the Sydney 2000 Olympics, and led the development of digital publishing for Thompson's in the Asia Pacific in the 1990s. We are also joined by Josh Salinas. Josh is an attorney in the Los Angeles office of Cyforth Shaw, practicing in the areas of trade secrets, privacy, restrictive covenants, computer fraud, and commercial litigation. As I mentioned, my name is Robert Milligan. I'm a partner in Los Angeles of Cyforth Shaw. My practice encompasses a wide variety of commercial litigation and employment matters, including general business disputes, unfair competition, trade secret misappropriation, and other intellectual property theft. We're so glad that you've joined us for today's presentation on big data. Josh is going to cover big data basics. And in a nutshell, my favorite definition of big data is essentially a computer analysis of torrents of information to find hidden gems of insight. Josh will get into more details regarding the term big data. We will also discuss deriving valuable insights from big data. As many of you know, there's been lots of highly publicized stories about the value and the benefits of big data, whether it's the Google flu trends being able to predict where the outbreak of the flu will come next based upon keyword searches in Google, or whether it was what New York City was able to do in helping predict where the next manhole explosion would be based upon looking at government records. Or whether it was the analysis of some scientists that were able to look at internet keyword search queries to find a correlation between the use of one prescription drug for antidepressant and another prescription drug for cholesterol, and see that there was real relationships and correlations that when you would mix those two prescription drugs, you would have nearly fatal side effects. John will get into some of the risks and challenges to privacy, trade secrets, and other IP. Anthony will provide, in his portion of the presentation, an international perspective, whether it's the EU or Australia. Anthony recently participated in the Microsoft Privacy Summit in Redmond, Washington, put forward by Microsoft, where they tackled some of these challenging issues that come up in big data. And one of the biggest challenges to big data, apart from trade secret and computer fraud concerns, is primarily privacy. While there's many valuable benefits from using big data, one of the challenges in today's notice and consent framework is how to use big data effectively by corporations while not violating the current privacy strictures. So Anthony will get into sort of an international and a big picture policy type perspective on the use of big data and what changes may need to be made to the big data, to the privacy framework in order to realize the benefits. John will explain some of the challenges in the United States and some of the key U.S. legislation and proposed legislation that imposes strictures and limitations on the use of big data. I will get into a discussion about how big data may impact trade secret protections, as well as some recent cases in the computer fraud and abuse area that limit the ability to do web scraping and other mining of data on the internet. And then finally, we'll conclude with some best practices for companies if they want to get into the big data arena, or maybe they're already embarking on their big data projects and wanted some best practices about how to manage some of the risks and legal liabilities. With that, I'll turn it over to Joshua DeSlinas to get into some of the nuts and bolts about big data. We assume that our audience has some general familiarity with big data, but it will provide some elementary insight, and it will also appeal to an audience that's much more sophisticated. We thought one good example of illustrating for those that are not that familiar with the concept of big data is actually a video that's available on the ACLU website considering ordering a pizza. And it's a simple customer transaction. Somebody calls in to order a pizza, and the breadth and wealth of information that the particular business has about that particular information. The video itself can be found on the ACLU website. And obviously the import of the video is to warn consumers about the information that being collected and some of the trouble that can be had with information that's collected and made that the business may know about you. But it also shows some of the benefits that can be had with big data. So essentially when the person calls in, the pizza company had easy access to the caller's name, contact information, and national ID number. Now, that may be a little bit disconcerting, but certainly it could help with in order to facilitate the transaction. Additional information was available about the caller concerning their medical and health history, and there was essentially an agreement with the insurance company to sell pizza to the caller only if he had agreed to waive any liability, and that was based upon their health history. So again, it's painting kind of a stark and disturbing concept of information that's gathered about individuals, but certainly businesses and retailers can see some of the value in capturing data about a particular individual and being able to provide them with better services and better products. There was also a delivery surcharge for the purchaser being in a high crime area. And there was a robbery that was detected the day before, and that impacted the pricing. And you've probably seen that in some realms. There's been some published reports that the price of a particular equipment can be determined based upon the type of PC that you're using, whether you're using a Macintosh computer or whether you're using a PC-type computer. There's been some published reports that pricing, particularly airfares, are impacted by the type of your computer. Again, on this particular example, there was information about the history regarding expensive purchases that the purchaser had made in the past that indicated that they could afford a more expensive transaction on the particular call. And it also had information regarding its credit history that required that the purchaser of the pizza couldn't purchase using a credit card, but would have to purchase in cash. And John will, of course, get into that discussion about the Fair Credit Reporting Act when we get into the discussion about some of the strictures on United States law. But I would ask you that to take a look at that video. It pretty highlights some of the valuable information that can be collected about individuals and some of the challenges from an ethical as well as a legal framework in using some of the benefits that can be derived from big data. With that, I'll turn it over to Josh.
Thanks, Robert. So a lot of us have probably heard about big data, the buzzword of big data. It's been in the news, the media, there's commercials, and so it's kind of this hot new technology And to give kind of a simple overview of what it is we've just amassed so much information, so much data. There's data in a wide range of industries, but in a variety of different formats. And I think it's reported that every single day about 2.5 quintillion bytes of data is generated. And big data not just necessarily involves this large amount of data, but actually the rapid amount that actually is being accumulated as well every single day in a variety of different formats. People are on social media putting emotionally laden posts and statements about different products or their preferences. Many people have mobile devices that are able to show their GPS locations or different websites or apps they're using. And just in general online transactions, there's so much data as now everything's either online, electronic, or digitalized. And so being able to not only collect and store this vast amount of data, but being able to process it, to analyze it, and derive some value, some use in that data is really what the value of big data is about. And so many people hear big data and they think, it's big, it's the size, the volume, but not necessarily. It's this variety of information, whether it's in a different media, a video, a picture, an emotionally laden post. It's that variety that really adds to the value. And so we've seen, that big data has really kind of become more and more popular as of recent. And it's seen as this, new disruptive technology, this new game changer. And part of it is because some of the technology that has facilitated and really fueled this revolution, it's similar to cloud computing's kind of development ascent, to the sense of it's a technology that has kind of existed before, but it's really become more and more prevalent and more popular because of certain advancements in technology. And one of them is with the rise in storage costs and the actual rise in storage capacity and the accompanying lowering in the storage costs, making it a lot more affordable. And the cost to actually store all this immense amount of data is becoming more doable. But also we've seen with some of the new data analytics technologies. And for example, one of the most popular platforms that's being used is called Hadoop, and it's an open source platform. And without getting into too much technical detail, what this software, this platform allows you to do is it distributes the storage and processing of the data over multiple clusters or groups of computers. So instead of having one single machine processing this data, it's actually distributing all these resources and processing over to thousands. And so it's definitely facilitated the ability to analyze these large and wide variety of information and data. And we've also seen with cloud computing, it's facilitated the rise with big data. And some other technologies such as vision recognition, which is able to look at pictures or other visual media and derive some type of information from that. And so big data, it's really analyzing your data in these unstructured formats that you couldn't, that were a lot more difficult to analyze before. And so what we've seen with big data is they expect by looking at, data in a variety of different areas, you're seeing these unknown correlations that you may not have noticed before. And so the idea is that the sum of these data sets may be more valuable than the actual parts. You're able to look at individual pieces of data in different areas and see these correlations, these relationships to either develop preferences or make predictions or kind of identifying what's going on. And so it has the value of showing, how consumers are acting, how we live our daily lives, how we work, how we play, but also how businesses, how they're conducting business, how, if their operations are being more effective or not. And so looking at essentially all this data, it allows you to get more information because traditionally you would look at, sampling and take a small amount of information. But with big data now, you have the capacity to look at almost all the information, all the data that's available, and run your analysis. And so actually, what is the definition of big data? There's still kind of no concrete definition, but there was an informal study conducted on LinkedIn And, you know, the question was asked, you know, what is big data and why does it matter? And some of the answers that were given were, you know, one, big data is collected from the web and is therefore, you know, the public domain. And then another response was, you know, no, actually I thought big data was, you know, unstructured data rather than publicly available data. And then somebody else said, you know, that's a good question, but it's really about the enormity of the data and the lack of structure or normalization. And then my favorite response was actually the last one is, you know, when in doubt, read Wikipedia's definition, and then if you don't agree with it, then write a new one. Now, we've seen some organizations, some groups have offered, you know, a definition, one by the McKinsey & Company, which is a global consultant firm, or a management consultant firm, said that it's an attempt to manage increasingly large and complex amounts of data that cannot be easily processed, stored, and analyzed using traditional analytical tools. Now, probably the most commonly used definition, though it's a little bit more flexible, is the four Vs. Traditionally, you had the three Vs, which I believe are proposed by the Gartner Group, and it's volume, velocity, and the variety of data. Now, recently, I think IBM has introduced a fourth V, the veracity of data. Now, these four factors, when analyzed, kind of show, you know, what actually is big data. And the first one, volume, which is probably the most simple and easy to understand, is these large amounts of data, this, you know, enormous amounts of data. As we said, you know, about 2.5 quintillion bytes of data are produced every single day. But that's not necessarily the limit of just big data. It's also the velocity of data. And it's the amount of data that's being generated and produced, you know, every single day, every single hour. And sometimes while companies can store and collect data, being able to stay up with the amount of data that's being produced can be overwhelming. And then the third one is the variety of data. As we've seen, data is now no longer in kind of the structured traditional formats, but we have social media posts, GPS information. You have a wide variety of devices now that are being, you know, sensors that are being incorporated, for example, in automobiles, you know, music and videos. And so all this data is in, you know, a wide variety of formats, but that actually increases the value by providing more valuable information. And then finally, the last one, the veracity of data, really that goes to the trustworthiness of the data. While you have a large amount of data, you know, how much do you actually trust it, you know, when you're collecting it? And so looking at this four Vs kind of gives an easier way to understand, you know, what actually big data is. Now, kind of to demonstrate and illustrate those four Vs is to see with social media the amount of data that's being produced, you know, every single day. With Facebook, they have about 1 billion monthly active users who are generating 2.7 billion page likes and uploading 350 million photos every single day. And as we'll discuss in a later slide, those page likes can actually give, you know, significant information about the personality or the characteristics of that person. With Twitter, you have 200 million monthly active users who are sending about 400 million tweets every single day. But probably even more valuable is that about 60% are accessing their using Twitter and sending those tweets through a mobile device. And so a lot of times there's information about the location of that person that's also being generated. With LinkedIn, there's about 200 million users, and every single second they have about two new members. And so you have that data being created with relationships and the information they post. And finally, which kind of surprised me, was with YouTube. Well, they have 1 billion monthly active users. About every single second, they're uploading an hour of video. So probably by the time we've finished with just this slide, somebody's, you know, or collectively people have uploaded about, you know, 24 hours or a day of video. And so as we've previously mentioned with the liking on Facebook, there was a recent study done by Cambridge University in the UK and a Microsoft research study. And what they did is they looked at about 58,000 volunteers' Facebook likes, and they were surprisingly able to make very highly and sometimes scarily accurate predictions about the person's, you know, the private and sensitive attributes. For example, just by looking at these likes of different pages, they were able to predict the person's sexual orientation, ethnicity, religious and political views, personality traits, intelligence, happiness, and a wide variety of other things. And it's very valuable from a targeted marketing perspective, but also other industries that may find value in that information as well. And so what we've seen is this rise in the amount of data that's being generated and created, and the value that's being made on these social media networks. There's a real value in data, and so the kind of currency of the future is this trend in the monetization of data. And we've seen with the sale of different social media networks, there's the doubling of LinkedIn's members to go from 100 million to over 200 million, the recent sale of Skype, and other successful business models of Facebook, which have really shown to companies that they can have this wealth of data and provide valuable information. And so we've seen, the data that's being created, there's not necessarily value simply in the data itself alone, but how it's being generated and where it's being generated. The real value is being in these markets, in these networks, and in these communities that are revealing information that may have not otherwise be seen, just watching how people interact. And so one of the concerns, later we'll discuss some of the privacy and other legal issues, but there's the idea that big data, how these predictions and how these this information is going to be used when you have these algorithms run by a computer. What are the inferences that are being made by somebody? How confident is there an overconfidence or over-reliance? One of the things that comes to mind is the movie with Tom Cruise, The Minority Report. I remember in the opening of the movie, a police officer busts into a room, and there's a man who has a knife or a scissors and about to stab somebody, and the cop places him under arrest and says, "You're under arrest for the future murder of this woman." And so there's some concern or some conspiracy theorist that there's going to be this use of big data to predict future crimes and to stop people before it happens. And it goes back to the idea of innocent until proven guilty, which was developed by a banister and a judge, Sir William Garrow, who brought this idea, there's a presumption of innocence until you're proven guilty. And so there's, that concern of, how much big data is going to be used to somebody and automatically, use it or kind of convict them or say they're guilty before, there's any other information provided. There have been police departments that are using big data to reduce crime from, L.A. or Virginia, New York, where they're able to use data to specifically target or strictly scrutinize certain streets, certain neighborhoods, certain gangs, or certain individuals that they believe may be more susceptible or more prone to predicting an imminent crime. There's a FAST program by the Department of Homeland Security. I think FAST stands for the Future Attribute Survey Technology. And what it's actually doing is looking at certain factors to identify terrorism, looking at individuals' vital signs, their body language, certain physiological patterns. And they found that with about 70% accuracy that they are able to at least predict the intent or possibility of a future crime or intent to do harm. So kind of going back to actually what, how companies can use big data, what does it provide, what is the value? There's a couple examples that there were previously unknown correlations that were discovered. For example, one of the early uses in big data was by credit card companies. And when looking at the reports of credit card fraud or identity theft, they found two significant predictors were actually, one, the amount of purchase, and two, the time of purchase at gas station pumps, the pay at pumps. And what they found is usually if a credit card purchase was done, after midnight or, late evening or early morning, and for about $1 or less than $1, those were significant predictors of credit card theft. And the reason behind it they found was that if somebody stole a credit card or made a copy, what they usually do is the probably best place to actually test that card out is at one of those pay at the pump stations, because you have nobody there, it's just a machine. And one of the risks of, for that person is actually being caught. So the alleged thief is able to, you know, scan the card, and if it, you know, works, you know, they've kind of verified that they can continue to use it somewhere else. But if there's, you know, rejection or it's reported stolen, the person can then just take off and leave. And so you don't have that fear of somebody, you know, seeing you in person and risk being caught or risk being detected. Another one is with Target saw that one of the predictors of pregnancy was if someone was purchasing unscented lotions and supplements and vitamins. And they found that based on, you know, purchasing patterns, they were able to predict what, you know, stage even in pregnancy that person was. And why that's significant and important is a lot of those stores, such as Target or Walmart, have recognized that, you know, one of the most vulnerable times to get into somebody to become, you know, their go-to store to be integrated into their purchasing habits is that time when a couple, you know, is having their first child. And one of the reasons is because the, you know, purchasing patterns and, you know, the lifestyles, everything's in flux at that point. And so by, you know, sending targeted coupons, targeted marketing, you're able to develop that relationship and then hopefully kind of develop that into a more permanent relationship for future on. And then finally, we saw with Walmart is they were looking at various inventory sales, but looking at other factors such as, you know, weather, time, and related purchases. And one of the things they didn't realize but found was that right before hurricanes, one of the most popular sales was strawberry Pop-Tarts, and they saw a 7x increase in sales. And while, you know, it shows that, okay, you know, they saw a factor of an increase in product sales and increase in profits, it kind of reflects that companies can look at stuff that they never would have thought before, for example, weather patterns and specific product sales. And so kind of to wrap up the use of using big data, really, you know, you have these unknown correlations, but the real value is actually how you're going to implement it, how you're going to utilize it. And so, for example, companies have been using it by looking at all the data for their internal complaints, internal reports, looking at, you know, the geography of those reports or specific, you know, managers or employees, specific landmarks, holidays, and by doing that, addressing and identifying organizational issues that they may have, and then proactively address those issues and then go to their insurance provider and, you know, either request a lower premiums or lower cost by showing that they have, you know, reduced these potential issues. Xerox and other companies are now using big data in hiring decisions and recruiting. Other insurance companies are using it to set, you know, better rates, looking at their consumer behavior. While some companies have looked at, you know, using traditional, you know, blood and urine samples, now they found that some of the more accurate predictors for developing rates are actually the consumer patterns, how that person, you know, what are they eating, what are they buying, where are they shopping. UPS is looking at, you know, different trucks, and other companies are looking at the equipment to monitor, you know, when they need maintenance and to replace certain things. Healthcare industry is using it to, for example, look at financial credit scores that they might predict, you know, how likely a person is to take their medicine. As Robert mentioned, Google Flu Trends was more accurate in predicting the spread of diseases because it's able to look at real-time search results to predict location of the spread of disease, whereas, you know, other organizations such as the CDC have to wait, you know, a day or 2 days to get their reports from doctors. And one of the, you know, companies that has been using big data and kind of integrated into the entirety of their department is Ford Motor Company, who has housed sensors in their vehicles for testing. They're generating information from, you know, sensors of the vehicles that produce the product lines. And so you've seen just, you know, a wide range of industries that you can use big data, but also get information and apply it. With that, I'll turn it over to Robert Milligan.
Hi, this is Robert Milligan with Sci-Far Shaw. It's my great pleasure to introduce our next panelist, Anthony Wong. Anthony is a principal of multidisciplinary legal and consulting practice specializing in information and communications technology, including intellectual property, licensing, internet and cyber law, cloud computing, security, privacy, and data protection law. Anthony is the immediate past president of the Australian Computer Society. Anthony also led the development and transformation of Thomson, now Thomson Reuters, in the Asia-Pacific to embrace the digital revolution. Anthony also served as the president of New Zealand Society for Computers and the Law. and hosted the launch of New Zealand's first Privacy Act. Anthony recently participated in the Microsoft Global Summit on Privacy in Sydney in August of 2012 and Seattle in September of 2012 on the issues of big data. And it was my pleasure to work with Anthony on a panel recently on big data and privacy in Scottsdale, Arizona, at the International Technology Law Association Conference in May of 2013. Anthony is going to discuss some of the risks and challenges that are involved with big data, specifically on data privacy concerns, and he's going to share some of his high-level perspective on the topic of big data. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Anthony for his thoughts.
Thank you, Robert. Robert, first of all, I'd like to thank you and your firm for inviting me to join you for this seminar. Good morning and good evening from me. Very happy to be here and to talk about the issues of big data and privacy. It was not so long ago in 1993 when we looked at the issues around the internet and the issues about knowing who is on the internet. And there was a column in the New York Times in July 5th, 1993, which talked about on the internet, nobody knows you are a dog. But 10 years later, by 2013, this year, with big data, we not only know the dog's age, which training school it goes to, what food it likes, who it plays with, and where it goes for walks. So times have definitely changed from the early days of the internet. And big data is now really looking at changing the very traditional roles and businesses that we're looking at today. So first of all, I'd like to look at how it's changing for two particular businesses around the world. And the first and foremost, the financial institutions. We know in the last couple of years, most financial institutions, including banking institutions, have been busy about complying with money laundering legislation around the world. And the phrase about knowing your customer and discovering not only they are complying with money laundering legislation, but the banks and financial institutions are now looking at sitting on the gold mine of information about their customers, particularly transactions about where they shop for their products and services, where they go to buy and the favorite restaurants they would go to, where they go for holidays around the world, and particularly also about providing new non-financial services to their customers. So we're looking at the changing roles of banks and financial institutions. They're not only offering us services in financial products, but they're now looking at travel and insurance products as well. In a similar fashion, looking at the telecommunication industry, we also notice telecommunication providers are now not only servicing you in terms of providing you telecommunication services and looking at your payment transactions and service plans. Now they also have a tremendous amount of information about your movements and places where you visit, particularly through tracking you through your mobile devices. And with that, the ability to look at providing additional services to you, as well as promoting targeted marketing products and services based on your particular geolocation and any particular point in time, space, and date. Also looking at the content that you subscribe. So most telecommunication players have now gone into the entertainment business, movie subscription and DVD and online delivery of entertainment content, and the list goes on and on. So with us with big data and the big data revolution, the challenges for us now is moving to the future, looking at the potential use of not just the primary information gathered by traditional players, but looking at potential secondary users, which perhaps was not disclosed in the original collection and notification. As the realities and ramifications of big data starts to sink in, the questions now revolve around what are the boundaries of big data? What can people actually use this data for its ethical use, research or analysis? Because currently we are now debating and looking at the challenges confronting our existing privacy frameworks and the principles that we have lived with over the last 30 to 40 years, including the definition of what is personal data, or in the Australian context, what is personal information. The principles of data minimization. Thirdly, the purpose limitation, the purpose for the gathering or collection of the information in the first place. And fourthly, the concept of giving consent for the gathering of, or collection. One of the challenges with big data is revolving about the identification and anonymization of data. Do they work now in the era of where we're looking at? Recent study suggests not. Once the information is out there and gathered, it's very hard to control with the advanced analytics that we have today. It's quite easy to do profiling using different sets of publicly available as well as private data sets of information. And that definitely poses a challenge to the current privacy framework. One particular highlight that I like to draw the audience attention to is this particular scenario. If we collect and use data which are not personal information or personal data to start with, but as a result of the analysis using the sophisticated systems that we have, the correlation, the aggregation, triangulation, all the buzzwords in the big data arena, and we can draw inferences bordering towards creating profiles and attributes about a person, and perhaps more towards personal data or personal information, would that come within the meaning and framework of our existing privacy legislation around the world? I'd like to draw the audience to two particular sets of legislation, firstly the Australian perspective, and then to draw our audience attention quickly to the EU perspective. Recently, Australia has just modified and amended the Australian Privacy Act, which and the new act will come into force in March 2014. And with that, we have a new definition about what it means in relation to personal information. And here for the very first time, the Australian privacy legislation talks about identifiable or reasonable identifiable individual. And that's in line with legislation in the EU as well in a number of Asia Pacific forums. So for the first time, the Australian perspective is drawing attention to information which could provide or draw aspects to an identifier person. If we looked at the explanatory memorandum in recent legislation on its passage to the Parliament, it talks about reasonable identifier means and depends on the context and circumstances in which the information is collected and held. And it draw a couple examples to what it meant by reasonable identifiable. Unfortunately, the memorandum uses words that's perhaps outdated in the arena of big data by drawing parallels to linking the information, rather than words that we use in the big data arena like correlation, aggregation, or triangulation. Under the EU perspective, Article 2A defined personal data to mean any information relating to an identified or identifiable natural person. And it further actually explained what it means by an identifiable person. And it talks about in reference to a number of factors, including references to a physical, physiological, mental, economic, cultural, or social identity factors about a particular individual, whether directly or indirectly. And in that respect, the recital to the EU directive talks about information held plus the results of reasonable inquiries. So if a particular information can be drawn to a particular identifiable person using big data, perhaps we would suggest that parts could be caught under the particular meaning of the EU directive. As I said early on, big data challenges existing frameworks and principles, not only relating to definition of personal information, it also challenges our current principles of data minimization, the purpose limitation, and the concept of consent. Current principles around the world centered on the individual and notice and consent. The big questions now with big data is that currently still realistic, practical, and feasible? Or are notice and consent, are they dead in the era of big data? Recently, at the Microsoft Global Privacy Summit, 70 individuals from around the world gathered in Redmond, Washington, to debate and discuss exactly that issue. Drawn from 19 countries over five continents, participants came together to consider the future of data sources and uses and practical steps to enhance privacy protection, and also looking at the OECD principles that was drawn up 30 years ago. Some of us like to draw our audience's attention to five key findings from the regional briefings meeting held in a number of cities around the world, and also in Redmond, Washington. The very first key finding from the report, which you can retrieve from the URL from the web, which is available on the PowerPoint, talks about notice and consent, that our current frameworks perhaps would not be sustainable with big data in the face of huge increase in volume and velocity of data. And secondly, that because of those two V's, as we say, there are actually three V's, volume, variety, and velocity, which our previous panel members have alerted you to. But in particular, in relation to the two V's, volume and velocity, it is currently not desirable because big data, because of that velocity and volume, are placing huge burden on individuals to provide their consent. And the question now is whether the consent will be informed in relation to the usage for those big data. The second primary findings from the report and the forum talks about the shift that we need to start thinking about shifting from the data subject towards data users, as in the users of information, and perhaps looking at the focus on accountability for responsible data stewardship. Expanding on the concept of data stewardship, the forum suggests that we need better security for personal data and a model which will ensure a high degree of confidence. And that's not only to cope with the changing global security standards and the constantly changing nature of our security challenges, protecting the information that we have currently. In relation to that third key finding, the forum debated and discussed in relation to enforcement and found that enforcement is a very critical element of data protection, especially in the era of big data. And that by giving the force of law to institutions or to privacy commissioners to actually enforce privacy legislation and also compliance with the principles. The fourth finding from the forum talks about drawing data protections law perhaps towards avoiding the harm or the impact to the individual, rather than just concentrating on the aspects of collection and consent, and that the harm and impacts to the individual should be expanded to include not only physical and financial injury, but also to look at the broader concepts consistent with protecting privacy as a human right, such as reputation or social harm. The last key findings from the fifth and last key findings from the report suggest that despite the limitation of the current notice and consent provision in most privacy legislation, even in the world of big data, this principle will continue to play a role, although it has to be modified in certain aspects to cope with big data. And on that note, I'd like to pass back to Robert for more discussion and questions.
Thank you so much, Anthony. We got a number of great questions while you were presenting. You mentioned there may be some ethical challenges with respect to big data. Could you provide some high-level discussion about some of those ethical challenges that companies may face in the big data world?
Just to get clarity, Robert, is that to the individual or ethical questions for the data users? So we're talking about the data subjects or the data users?
The data users.
So data users, those would be the agencies or institutions using the information or personal information about individuals. I think the, one of the complexity that we've debated during the forum was the fact that there are varying degrees of ethical standards around the globe because of cultural differences, languages, and different societies have different perspectives about ethics. What could be ethical to one country may not be to another. So because of the cultural differences, it is very difficult to get a global standard or a platform that is harmonized across the globe. And that places difficulty in this area of big data. Also, from the debates around big data, some people are suggesting that rather than privacy frameworks, whether legislation should fall back onto the moral standards of ethics according to that level held with that community, whether that would be a better platform to look at the harm and impacts of the uses of data on the community that's relevant and tied to that ethical platform. Does it answer your question, Robert?
Yes, very much so. We got another question with respect to your experience at the Microsoft Privacy Summit. The question is related to the accountability on the data user using the data, and did you glean any good principles or something that resonated with you as far as what that type of accountability would be for the entity using the data?
During the forum, the participants looked at the accountability principles in the OECD. One of the principles talked about accountability. And perhaps that's something that we globally have not really looked at in terms of privacy enforcement and practices. In the past, we predominantly, I think it's a fair comment to say that we have been concentrating on collection and consent and purpose and not looking at the end about the data stewardship, about if you hold information about individuals, there is a stewardship element and there's an accountability element, and that should be safeguarded together with the proper enforcement procedures provided by law to make sure the accountability and the harm that's not impacted on individuals.
Then one last question we got is about this concept you discussed about, you know, is notice and consent dead in the world of big data? And one of the questions relates to whether you have any sort of predictions about, you know, whether that's is that likely to occur, and if so, what do you think the world is going to change from notice and consent to something different?
That's a very good question, Robert. Thank you for asking that question. Personally, it's my belief and understanding that obviously with the current form of consent and data, it's a number of situations with big data, it may be difficult to actually attain or receive consent because of the three V's that we highlighted early on in this presentation. Three V's, first being velocity, variety, and volume. And with those three combinations, it's a practical question as to whether it's possible to actually receive informed consent. We may get consent, but would that be informed in the circumstances and the situation? Would that place too much a burden on the data subject, knowing that now we're talking about real-time information, and with information overload, do we have the luxury of continuously giving our consent to our information being processed anywhere, everywhere in real time? So definitely that's a challenge that needs to be resolved. I believe notice and consent are not dead in the era of big data, but suddenly something has to change to cope with new situations, specific examples, some which we already seen, which we've drawn through with examples that we've seen today, and some are yet to transpire in the near future. So I think it's a modified form of consent moving forward. It still has a role to play, but definitely in terms of other types of more secondary and big data, we need to investigate the question about accountability, the data stewardship, and the harm and impacts, plus the enforcement of those things. So I think there are definitely challenges ahead, but definitely that's an interesting question. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Thank you for your time and sharing your insights. You're a real expert in this area.
My pleasure, and thank you for your firm for inviting me to join you for this interesting, exciting panel. Thank you.
So, thank you, everybody. This is John Tomaszewski, and we've just gone over a number of really interesting concerns on an international aspect, but what I'd like to do is take this opportunity right now to really start discussing the real and practical concerns around big data here in the United States. While a lot of Europeans like to say that the United States doesn't really have data protection law, I would offer that actually our challenge is we have a lot more data protection law because it tends to be sectoral. Obviously, the first place to look at this is how the FTC, as the default regulator around data protection, is looking at data brokers. This is a challenge because a lot of folks who are using big data don't realize that they actually may fall into the definition of data broker. This is also true at the state level. For example, the state of Georgia has a law regulating security breach notifications if you are a data broker. And their definition of data broker is not the traditional one of, oh, you're a credit reporting agency. It's more one of, are you collecting information from third parties about people and are selling that information in profile form for money? That looks a heck of a lot like a lot of different business models that are floating around out there. And as a consequence, you really need to consider your use, as was noted before, as potentially inadvertently triggering a series of regulatory regimes that you may not be aware of in the first place. The most obvious is the FTC and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The example presented in this particular slide notes the Spokio settlement in 2013, and Spokio didn't think that they were a data broker, or in this instance, a credit reporting agency. The FTC disagreed with them, and as a consequence, they ended up with a consent decree and a 20-year relationship with the FTC, which people obviously don't want because it's expensive. So there's a definite risk in terms of collecting information and using information, especially for a secondary purpose, which was already previously noted. There's also questions around whether or not the internal mechanics or technology is going to have an impact on you as well, because you may be using Google Analytics well, is that tracking? Is that tracking that needs to be identified in a Do Not Track header? Right now, the World Wide Web Consortia has not finalized their standard around that, and so this is going to continue to be challenging just from a high-level perspective. On top of that, we're starting to see a movement away from the definition of personally identifiable information, which was under the traditional security breach notice statutes, to one that's looking a lot more like the European model, which is, can you identify a discrete individual, not is it just their social security number? The first place we saw that was COPPA. The new regulations on COPPA also were bringing in a broader scope of potential, quote, operators, unquote. And as a consequence, there's this need for companies who are collecting and using information to be more aware of how they're doing it. A lot of kids under the age of 13 have cell phones. A lot of kids under the age of 13 are using online gaming environments. Facebook was reported as having 7 million children under the age of 13 as users, even though their terms and conditions say you can't do that. So the regulatory regime is very real, and it's very much one that, unless you're aware of, it can really pull you into an environment that you didn't realize that you were in. Another good example is health and fitness apps. Most of these apps are developed by a small team of developers in someone's basement or in someone's garage, and they're grabbing very sensitive information. Even under traditional American tort law, the concept of libel and slander recognize publication of information that's sensitive, specifically, at least at the common law, health information, whether or not you had a particular disease or anything that would subject you to societal ridicule. These are the types of things that potentially could be transmitted or collected via an app. There's a huge number of opportunities for positive support, whether it's Nike's apps or it's a new developer's apps, but these are situations that need to be evaluated when you're looking at developing the app, using the data, making sure the data is used in a way that is consistent with the expectation of the data subject. As I said earlier, privacy information is not going to be going away anytime soon because it sells newspapers, and we have a lot of pending legislation. The Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights that came out in February 2012 from the White House also recognizes the international flavor because it specifically referenced the APEC work that's going into the Cross-Border Privacy Rules Initiative. California has a social networking privacy bill out there. There are, at last count this year, 8 specific social networking privacy bills in play, not including the ones that had already passed. The other thing that's interesting is if you go and you look at state laws regulating specific use of data or collection of data, you find a wide variety of laws that are dealing with this. You have 46 different security breach notification statutes along each state. California has well over 60 separate laws dealing with confidentiality and security of information. So collection and use of this information very easily may trigger a legal obligation associated with the information that is being collected. Finally, well, not finally, but realistically, one of the other challenges is now you've got the information, what can you do with it, and what's the probability of you having a security breach? Information is a very, very volatile item. It is difficult to maintain in a secure format. Not impossible, but it's very hard. As a consequence, invariably you're going to end up with a situation that data went into the wrong place. Does it rise to the level of a data breach? Is it something that, if it shows up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, that your company is going to care about? These are definitely going to be issues that need to be addressed because they may trigger both legal liability as well as reputational risk, which is easily one of the damaging components to any business, the most obvious being card services, which had a breach back in the early 2000s, and without litigation is no longer in existence, simply because of the reputational damage to it. more specifically in the legal space, we've seen a trend develop where the traditional positioning of standing, where you need to have identifiable economic harm, is being reevaluated. Historically, courts have been loath to impose a liability on a company that's had a security breach where there's no quantifiable actual economic harm to the individual. We're starting to see a movement away from that, at least from a standing perspective. And so companies who've had data breaches are starting to run into the challenge of it's now more expensive to defend them because you can no longer move to dismiss for failure to state a claim. This is an additional cost associated with the calculus in terms of using big data or acquiring large troves of data. Since I know we're running short on time, I'm also going to move through this fairly quickly. So what are the ways that you can address these concerns? What are some standardized issues or best practices that you can use to cover the wide variety of laws that are floating around out there in the United States? The first and best place to look, honestly, is the Fair Information Practice Principles. Those were originally developed actually by the United States, not the Europeans, and have been the basis for all of the major privacy schemas floating around out there, including the European Data Protection Directive. They were developed in the 70s by Health Education and Welfare, now what is considered Department of Health and Human Services, and they are the best starting point. The other place to go is the European Union has an organization called the Article 29 Working Party, which is a consortia of all of the different data protection authorities. They provide opinions, which also give a good example on how to address the risks and challenges to processing data and collecting data, and how you do consent or not do consent. Finally, and this goes back to the big fundamental value of big data, is a lot of folks rely on anonymization. By its very nature, anonymization and big data are incompatible because the level of data you have about a discrete individual, it may not be his name, may not be a social security number, but you know enough that you can identify a discrete person. That's the fundamental purpose for big data, its predictive capacity. And as a consequence, simply saying, oh, well, we use big data, but we anonymize, is really somewhat of an oxymoron. This is very obvious when you look at the America Online incident and Netflix incidences in 2006, where they were publishing, quote, anonymized data, unquote, primarily for research purposes, but ended up being able to very quickly and very easily identify a discrete individual based on the anonymized data. The nature of big data makes it easy to re-identify folks from anonymized data, and as a consequence, it's very, very questionable to rely on anonymization as the silver bullet with regard to being able to use big data. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't use big data. There's a lot of value to big data, but you need to be conscious of the limitations of means of handling it and understand that there is no one silver bullet. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Robert to talk about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Thank you so much, John. I appreciate it. And thank you for the audience for being patient with us. We'd like to give you the CLE code now. The CLE code for today's program is SS9529. Again, today's CLE attendance verification code is SS9529. So we've gone through the big data basics. We've gone through the valuable insights that can be gleaned from big data. We've talked about utilizing the benefits of big data. And now John and Anthony have gotten into some of the risks and challenges in effectively using big data, namely privacy concerns. One of the other concerns that comes up in the big data world is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and how the explosion of big data will impact the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Now, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a federal statute that provides liability for anyone who intentionally accesses a computer without authorization or exceeds authorized access and thereby obtains information from any protected computer. The CFA requires that there be a minimum amount of damages of at least $5,000 over a one-year period. And you may be asking, well, how does it come up in the context of big data? And the answer is data scraping. Now, essentially, taking information off the internet, taking information off the websites, and using that for part of your big data analysis. Data extraction is another way that it's referred to. It's also called scraping, crawling, spidering. But essentially, using information that's publicly available on the internet as your data source for some of your data, big data analysis. And there's been some cases in this area. The case law is not very well developed, but there's been at least three big cases. One of the earlier cases was the Southwest Airlines versus Fair Chase Inc. case. It was a case out of Texas. And in that particular case, Fair Chase was using information about flights that was on the Southwest website and essentially scraping that information and using it for their business purposes. And the Southwest was able to maintain their Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim based upon a violation of their terms of service on their website, that essentially they were without authorized access when they took the data from the particular website. And that's consistent with another decision, the Snap-on Business Solutions case versus O'Neill. It's a federal case out of Ohio. And in that particular case, Snap-on had created a searchable online database for its client. And the client later decided to move the database to another service provider, O'Neill, but Snap-on refused to provide the database to the client unless the client paid an additional fee. It's a common scenario that we're seeing more and more. The client and O'Neill agreed that O'Neill would retrieve the data from Snap-on's database through the use of O'Neill's scraper tool. And if that doesn't put chills up the back of your neck, it should, because sometimes, whether it's lawful or unlawful, it could be just that you know you're going to get yourself into trouble if you do things like that. And that's exactly what happened. And later, O'Neill proceeded to scrape the data from the Snap-on database. And essentially, Snap-on later brought a lawsuit alleging a number of claims, including unjust enrichment, trespass to chattels, but also the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And at summary judgment, the court allowed the case to go forward and essentially said that there could be a claim under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for violating the agreement between the client and Snap-on, and that the scraping of the website was without authorized access. Now, there's also been another case that went the other way. It's the Cvent case. It's an Eastern District of Virginia case. And there the real focus was on, well, what did the terms of use on the website say and where were they located? And even though the terms of use stated that competitors were prohibited from accessing and utilizing the information on the website, the court held that there was no violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The court found that the terms of use were not sufficiently visible because the link was buried at the bottom of the page in an extremely fine print, and users had to scroll down to see it, thereby essentially rendering them insufficient protection for the site. So there's not a lot of case law in this area, but you can see that at least the courts that have weighed in on it to date are requiring very clear terms of service, more prominently pronounced, you know, not in small type. And I think the upshot is that in the big data world, that if you are going to be using information that's publicly available on websites, you need to make sure that you're complying with the terms of service. Otherwise, depending upon your jurisdiction and its application of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and state statutes for that matter that are analogous to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the use of that information can subject you to a tremendous amount of risk and liability. In fact, one of the more popular cases that you've heard about probably is the Weave case, and it was a conviction under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of a infamous internet troll and iPad hacker. And what he had discovered was a security hole in AT&T's server, and he was able to get from that server and get the customer's email addresses from his violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and essentially hacking that server. And he was sentenced to 41 months in jail. His conviction was appealed, and it's pending on appeal in the Third Circuit right now. But it could provide some additional insight about how violations of terms of service are going to be viewed going forward. And I think the main takeaway is that proceed at your own peril if you're going to be using information that's gleaned from websites in violation of the terms of service. Another consideration is, how does big data work in the world of trade secrets? And it's somewhat of a nuanced analysis, because the big, you know, draw of big data is lots of information, perhaps lots of publicly available information, and using all that different information and drawing correlations from that information. So at its first blush, it doesn't seem like trade secrets may play a role, but in fact they do play a very big role. You know, general definition of a trade secret, it's got to be information generally not known to others, economic valuable, and that you have reasonable efforts to maintain your secrecy. And so in the world of big data, you may say, well, yes, information, but it may not be generally not known to others, and there may not be reasonable efforts to maintain the secrets. And that's where the real challenge is in the big data world. Certainly, courts have found in the past that compilations of publicly available information that are put together by companies can be trade secrets. But the main value of big data are the correlations that are made. You know, in the case of Target, the correlation that the uptick in the sales of lotion and supplements may indicate that a person is, you know, pregnant, and that's where you would do your targeted marketing and advertising. The same thing with the keyword searches for prescriptions for the flu, and being able to predict if somebody, you know, if a particular area has a flu outbreak. The real takeaways are those sort of correlations between the two data sets. And so it's important when taking into account trade secrets and big data that the information itself needs to maintain secrecy. So if you find particular correlations, if a company finds the particular correlations by using their different data sets, and then they publicly disclose that correlation, in the case of the Target, in the case of the Google flu trends, well, it's no longer a secret then. But there may be instances where the company wants to maintain the secrecy of that correlation, where they want to be able to, perhaps they're trying to address ethical concerns or complaints for particular safety violations, and they do a big data analysis of a variety of different data sets, and they figure out that there's a correlation between a particular area of the country, a particular safety problem, and perhaps another data set. And they may not want to publicly disclose that. They want to keep that secret, confidential information, and then be able to improve upon what the issues were, so that they can perhaps go to their insurance carrier and get a reductions on premiums or whatnot. But all along the process, they'll need to keep the correlations, perhaps the data itself, confidential, secret, and if they are going to share it with third parties to get to either do the analysis or to get benefits from the analysis that was derived from the big data, they will need to keep that confidential, subject to a non-disclosure agreement with strong confidentiality protections. Another thing is that a lot of information that's publicly available may not be secret. It may just be difficult to obtain, and that comes up often in the sense of government records that may be, you know, squirreled away somewhere in a library or in a public records area, and that you may go and glean the information from those particular records and then later try to protect that information as trade secret. And it's often a challenge, because unless you're bringing in information from other sources, if you're just relying on the information itself that was publicly available, you're going to have a difficult time maintaining the secrecy of the information. But certainly if you're combining different sets of publicly available information into your own formula or own, you know, system and data set, you have a better chance of arguing that that particular information is trade secret. Another key consideration when it comes to trade secrets and big data is the underlying algorithm that goes into essentially crunching the data and providing you with the insight, the correlation, the prediction. And that's where, obviously, that's, you know, coming up with that algorithm and as it applies to the different data sets, that's where there's a key trade secret. And that's where the company, if they've invested time and effort in, you know, crunching the data and coming up with the correlation, that they make sure that they keep that information confidential, and that if they're working with data analysts and technologists, that they button those up with non-disclosure agreements and other restrictive type covenants, so that the correlations are not leaked, that the algorithms are not leaked, that the data sets and how they're combined are not leaked. It's all very important considerations in to take into account to make sure that you're doing big data correctly, and that you, after you've spent all this time and effort in doing the analysis, gathering the data, finding the correlations, that you don't lose out on the benefit of your investment. Because we're seeing lots and lots of pressure from the C-suite, marketing, to use big data, to employ big data in their companies, and there can be a lot of pushback or reservation from compliance and legal, and that's where there needs to be candid conversations about what it is you're trying to accomplish and where you're going to be gathering this information to do the big data analysis. On this next slide, we've talked about some of the values and the benefits of big data and some of the challenges and some of the concerns, and we wanted to leave you with some takeaways as far as best practices that we're seeing when companies are confronted from the C-suite and from the marketing department about wanting to use big data, and then how a legal department is, you know, and a legal department and compliance is addressing this. And some of the key takeaways in when you're putting together your big data plan is, make sure that whatever information that you're going to be using, that it complies with existing privacy policies. There's nothing special about big data that would take information that's subject to a privacy policy and take it outside of those legal requirements just because it's big data. The same requirements apply. And that's also to say that there's no free pass for research and development. So just because your company may be doing research and development, if you're going to be using information and that information is subject to privacy policies, you have to comply with those privacy policies. There's no special exception for research and development. So the best practice is to build a sandbox, and that is essentially a segregated server where the information is being brought in to do the big data analysis, and it needs to be walled off from the other parts of the servers where you may find proprietary data or other third-party system data. It needs to be a clear area where you can see how this particular big data set was built and developed, and you may want to be even meta tag that data as far as the time and source as when the particular information, the particular data set was inputted into the sandbox, so you have a clear chain of custody. So if there's a later dispute regarding web crawling or getting the information in violation of terms of service, you can say, no, we didn't get it from the internet. We got it from this other particular data provider, data broker, and they have a license for it. So that's why it can be important. I think one of the key takeaways is that the attorneys need to be involved as far as bringing data into the secured sandbox and taking data outside the secure sandbox. That's the only way a company can really make sure that they're trying to comply within the four quarters of the law with respect to privacy, trade secrets, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and other legal considerations. So you may be saying, well, maybe my privacy policies don't presently take into account the uses that we may want to use for this data. Well, that may be a restriction on why you would put that particular information into the sandbox, but it also provides a reminder that you may want to update your privacy policies so that you can capture data going forward and put it into that sandbox. And that's part of the analysis by updating your customer and your employee disclosures is very important, like we just said, as far as to maintain the secrecy of the information, that you control accesses and the use of the data, especially with third parties. You need to indicate who owns the data, your company, what the restrictions on the use of the data are, and a clear non-disclosure agreement, you know, preventing third parties who may have access to your data from disclosing the data, and certainly the correlations that you may make from the data. Because a lot of companies are not in the business of doing big data. They will contract with third parties, and so that's where it's important that the company be mindful that this is an ownership investment. This is something that they want to belong to them at the end of the day, and they need to button it up in the contracts. We talked a little bit about some of the challenges with anonymization, but to the extent possible, notwithstanding those challenges, data imported into the sandbox should be anonymized and not be re-identifiable. That's the best way to try to protect against privacy considerations, as well as a clear policy, a privacy policy that allow you to actually use the information. Another key takeaway, avoid third-party data that could have been collected by scraping and web crawling. As a result of this uncertainty under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, if you really are going to make key decisions and rely upon the big data, make sure that your big data is pure and clean and is not subjecting you to liability because it may have come from web scraping or web crawling. And it's also important that the terms of service and ask permissions may not be enough to cover future lawsuits. So you're going to be proactively looking for additional measures to take in your terms of service, in your ask permissions, in your privacy policies, so that you can continue, that you can collect the data that you want to collect and be able to put it into the sandbox for future use. And this doesn't all occur within a vacuum, and that's why we say that you need to align the risks, controls, and monitoring with the C-suite so they understand what the challenges and the marketing department are, so that they understand the challenges in using big data effectively so that the company doesn't get sued, and all the benefits that would derive from big data are outweighed by the legal risks. And then in conclusion, John and I were just going to go away, provide some additional best practices, principles, takeaways from this particular presentation. I think it's clear that the privacy concerns are going to continue to remain. The notice and consent framework that exists in the United States and other parts of the countries, parts of the world, is not going to go away. It's all about how big data is going to work its way into this world and how much is it going to change. It's important to note that even there's always data minimization initiatives that you essentially within your company that you destroy the data, and sometimes that is required by law. But what is clear is that data that's deleted is not deleted. Copies are still available on other servers, on the cloud, and can be recovered when deleted. So that's important to take into account as far as your best practices about, are you really complying with your data minimization initiatives, and then how does that really work within the world of big data? John, feel free to jump in at this point about some other key takeaways that you think the audience would appreciate.
Sure. I think the big thing to take away is know what you're doing and know why you're doing it, so that you don't end up with the law of unintended consequences coming back and biting you. Big data is a very, very powerful tool. It can create a lot of really good things, both from the perspective of the business as well as from the perspective of the data subject. I like the fact that Amex calls me when they get a charge on my Amex card in Bora Bora when I happen to be in San Francisco. But use is going to be a critical component. The other thing to consider that you need to look at is the idea that data by itself may not be personally identifiable, but when combined or triangulated with other data, it does become personally identifiable. And considering that flexibility and volatility of your environment is going to go a long way in being able to use the traditional means of managing risk, because they're out there. You can do that. There are a lot of ways to manage the risk. You just have to know what the risk is, and with big data, sometimes that's the hardest part.
Thanks so much, John. And for the audience, the PowerPoint will be available. We'll email you the PowerPoint. We'll also share with you some articles that we've authored in this particular area that you may find helpful, that help you sort of tackle some of the challenges in this area. Wanted to let you know about a programming note. We'll be having another Trade Secrets Non-Compete webinar next month, and it'll be upon non-compete considerations and trade secret considerations in Asia. So please look for the signups on that. And then also just a reminder to stay current on trade secret issues by visiting and registering for our blog at www.tradesecretslaw.com. Thank you so much for your time today. Have a great day.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes today's web conference, and you may now disconnect.